Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our beautiful Sufi temple here in Cape Town. So 2 weeks ago, I attended an event in our city's company gardens, and for the first time since my return to Cape Town late last year, I got that I'm back feeling in the Cape Townian sense of the word. This event was called Luminosity, and it was described as a captivating annual festival that transforms the city into a vibrant canvas of light. Like so? Off. Like this? Okay. Right, so, and it was all very impressive at this event. These incredible light installations in such a historic part of our city, right at the foot of the mountain, which was lit up as well. But what really stayed with me afterwards was a very simple installation that was part of the event. Just a big column of white light projected from the ground up into the night. And inside this column were hundreds of moths, just madly flying around. And their intoxication was so palpable that the sight in itself had become hypnotic. And a small crowd of people, myself included, gathered to watch. And then a week or so later, I read Rumi's poem, "Judge a Moth by the Beauty of Its Candle." And I couldn't help but think of these poor moths, trapped inside and intoxicated by this beautiful but totally transient pillar of light. In the Sufi message, our teacher, Hazrat Inayat Khan, who is also the man who brought the Sufi message from the East to the West in 1910, discusses this concept of intoxication in quite a number of times across various volumes and chapters. And in volume 6, The Alchemy of Happiness, he talks at length about the intoxication of life. But instead of light, he uses wine as a metaphor. He said, "Every stimulus that one experiences through food and drink is really a small intoxication. But it is not only the food that one eats, the water that one drinks, and all that one sees and hears and touches that has an influence, an effect on a person's being and intoxicates him or her. Even the air that someone breathes from morning till evening is continually giving them a stimulus and an intoxication. If this is true, is there then one moment when a person is not intoxicated? They are always intoxicated, only sometimes more so than others. The intoxication remains as a person goes on in life. There is only a change of wine. The wine of childhood is different from the wine of youth, and when the wine of youth is finished, some other wine is taken. Then, according to what walk of life a person follows, he or she drinks that wine which absorbs their life, either collecting wealth, or acquiring power, or seeking a position. All these are wines that intoxicate. And if one goes even further in life, intoxication still pursues one. It may be that one is interested in music or fond of poetry, or one may love art or delight in learning. It is all intoxication. If all these different occupations and interests are like different wines, what is there then in the world that can be called a state of soberness? It is wine indeed from beginning to end. Even those who are good and advanced, spiritual and moral, they also have a certain wine. One has to take wine all the way, but there are different wines. A highly advanced artist, a great poet, an inspired musician will admit that there are moments of intoxication which come to them through their art as a joy, an upliftment, and it makes them exalted, as if they were not living in this world." And then further on in volume 6, Inayat Khan then talks about the higher and the lower intoxications. The higher intoxication cannot be compared with the lower intoxication of this world, but it is still intoxication. What is joy? What is fear? What is anger? What is passion? What is the feeling of attachment and what is the feeling of detachment? All these have the effect of wine. All produce intoxication. Understanding this mystery, the Sufis have founded their culture upon the principle of intoxication. They call this intoxication hal, and hal means literally condition or state. There's a saying of the Sufis, man speaks and acts according to his condition. One cannot speak or act differently from the wine one has drunk. Everything a person does and says is according to the wine they have taken. That is why the Sufi says, heaven and hell are in the hand of man, if he only knew their mystery. And then Hazrat Inayat Khan shares this beautiful analogy. To a Sufi, the world is like a wine cellar, a store in which all sorts of wines are collected. He has only to choose what wine he will have and what wine will bring him the delight, which is the longing of his soul. Now, of course, in Sufism, wine and intoxication can also be metaphors for divine love and spiritual ecstasy, a state known as fana, that follows the annihilation of the ego. And this brings us to another central concept in Sufism, mutu kabla antak mutu, to die before you die. The death of the false self, the destruction of the ego, and then a rebirth into the real. In his chalas, Inayat Khan said, the true ego is born of the ashes of the false. And in the 10th Sufi thought, there is one path, the annihilation of the false ego in the real, which raises the mortal to immortality and in which resides all perfection. In the same chapter, still on the topic of intoxication, Inayat Khan continues, the whole of life is interesting because it is all intoxicating, but what is really desired by the soul is one thing only, and that is a glimpse of soberness. What is this glimpse of soberness, and how does one experience this glimpse of soberness, which is the continual longing of the soul? One experiences it by means of meditation, by means of concentration. But if it, intoxication, is a natural thing, why has one to make an effort for soberness? The reason is that one enjoys this intoxication so much that afterwards one becomes addicted to drink. And that is the condition of every soul in this world. Every soul becomes addicted to the wine of life. At the same time, there comes a moment, if not in the early part of life, then later. If not when a person is happy, then when he or she is unhappy, when they begin to look for that soberness, which is the continual longing of their soul. The Sufi culture, therefore, is a culture designed in order to experience that soberness. In his poem, The Center of the Fire, Rumi says, no more wine for me. I'm past delighting in the thick red and the clear white. I'm thirsty for my own blood as it moves into a field of action. And now, returning to the topic of this talk, a Sufi parable. One night, a group of moths gathered, saying, we must find someone who can tell us more about this mystery for which we yearn so deeply. One of the moths volunteered for the mission and flew to a far-off candle. As it flew past at a distance, it examined the candle from all angles. It even took a quick peek at the flame. This moth then returned, describing the candle to the others as intelligently and as eloquently as it could. But the wise old moth told the others, "Alas, our friend here has no real information for us about the candle or its flame." Another moth then went off to visit the candle. This one passed much closer to the light, drawing so near that the tip of its wing even touched the flame. But the heat's intensity drove it back, and the moth retreated to share its experience too. But the wise old moth said, "This explanation is not worth anything more than that of our first comrade." A third moth then rose up, intoxicated with longing. Flying straight towards the candle, it hurled itself into the flame. The others watched as this moth burned and burned. The wise old moth, looking on from afar, saw this moth glowing bright red and observed, "This brother not only burnt in the flame, in his burning he became the flame and also its light. What's more, in their union, the flame became our brother. He has fulfilled both his life's desire and his purpose, but he won't be back to share anything with us. Only he can comprehend the mystery to which he has attained." In volume one of the Sufi message, The Way of Illumination, in the chapter The Purpose of Life, we read, "There are five aspects which give one the tendency towards the accomplishment of the inner purpose. The desire to live, the desire to know, the desire for power, desire for happiness, and the desire for peace. These five things work, consciously or unconsciously, in the profound depth of every soul. Working within one, they prompt one either to do right or to do wrong. And yet these five aspects belong to the one purpose, in the accomplishment of which the purpose of the whole creation is fulfilled. When the desire to live, the first aspect, brings one in touch with one's real life, a life which is not subject to death, then the purpose of that desire is accomplished. When one has been able to perceive fully the knowledge of one's own being, which is to be found, in which is to be found divine knowledge and the mystery of the whole manifestation, then the purpose of knowledge, the second aspect, is achieved. When one is able to get in touch with the almighty power, then the desire for power is achieved, the third one. And the fourth, when one has been able to find one's happiness in one's own heart, independent of all things outside, the purpose of the desire for happiness is fulfilled. And the fifth aspect, when one is able to rise above all conditions and influences which disturb the peace of the soul, and has found one's peace in the midst of the crowd and away from the world, in this person, the desire for peace is satisfied. It is not in one or the other of these five desires that there is the accomplishment of the purpose. It is in the fulfillment of these five desires that one's purpose is accomplished, the purpose for which every soul was born on earth. If you are listening to this talk here in the Sufi temple in Cape Town today, or perhaps as a recording later, you might find phrases like the fulfillment of our soul's purpose and the true knowledge of our being a bit vague, perhaps cryptic, or even completely perplexing. I know I did more than a decade and a half ago, not just wondering about how I could discover my life's purpose or the true knowledge of my being, but also at a loss as to how and where I might take even a first step on this journey. A step towards that glimpse of soberness from all the intoxicating wines of the world. For me, that was to be found in mystical practice. And that first step was my initiation. In volume 10, Sufi Mysticism, our teacher describes initiation as only a step forward, a step that should be taken with hope and courage. And then it's also described that it is like the experience of a person who has never learned how to swim. He steps into the river or into the sea for the first time without knowing whether he will be able to float or whether he will be swept away and drowned. Now, initiation is definitely a topic worthy of its own universal worship talk. So I'll just say for now that for me, it feels like taking this step forward has transformed me over some time from the first moth to the second. And on a Wednesday evening when our inner school group meets here at the temple for our program of prayer, healing, meditation, music and movement, I get that third moth feeling, a taste of that one truth, the true knowledge of my being within and without. That experience for which there are no words. Prayer, meditation, music, movement. Some of you will know the essential Rumi, the translated works of the 13th century mystic poet by the US scholar Coleman Barks. So this is the introduction to chapter 27, The Turn, Dance in Your Blood. And in it, Barks writes, "The Turn, the moving meditation done by Mevlevi dervishes, originated with Rumi. The story goes that he was walking in the goldsmithing section of Konya when he heard a beautiful music in their hammering. He began turning in harmony with it, an ecstatic dance of surrender, and yet with great centered discipline. He arrived at a place where ego dissolves and a resonance with universal soul comes in. Dervish literally means doorway. When what is communicated moves from presence to presence, darshan occurs with language inside the seeing. When the gravitational pull gets even stronger, the two become one turning that is molecular and galactic, and a spiritual remembering of the presence at the center of the universe. Turning is an image of how the dervish becomes an empty place where human and divine can meet. To approach the whole, the part must become mad, by conventional standards at least. These ecstatic holy people, called madhsabs in the Sufi tradition, redefine this sort of madness as true health." When he saw the dervishes in Cairo in 1910, Rainer Maria Rilke, the great Bohemian spiritual poet, said this about the turn. "It is so truly the mystery of the kneeling, of the deeply kneeling man. With Rumi, the scale is shifted, for in following the peculiar weight and strength in his knees, he belongs to that world in which height is depth. This is the night of radiant depth unfolded." In his Book of Hours, there's this poem by Rilke. "God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, Go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. In volume 5 of the Sufi message, Spiritual Liberty, Inaya Khan says, "The spiritual pursuit, as Al-Ghazali says, is like shooting an arrow into the dark. You cannot see where it has gone or what it hits." To me, this feels like the definitive definition of what it means to be on this path, what it means to have faith. Once the arrow has left the bow, the only thing you'll ever know for certain again is that there's no turning back. I'd like to close with the poem, "The Center of the Fire" by Rumi. No more wine for me. I'm past delighting in the thick red and the clear white. I'm thirsty for my own blood as it moves into a field of action. Draw the keenest blade you have and strike until the head circles about the body. Make a mountain of skulls like that. Split me apart. Don't stop at the mouth. Don't listen to anything I say. I must enter the center of the fire. Fire is my child. But I must be consumed and become fire. Why is there crackling and smoke? Because the firewood and the flames are still talking. You are too dense, go away. You are too wavering, I have solid form. In the blackness, those two friends keep arguing, like a wanderer with no face, like the most powerful bird in existence, sitting on its perch, refusing to move. What can I say to someone so curled up with wanting, so constricted in his love? Break your pitcher against a rock. We don't need any longer to haul pieces of the ocean around. We must drown, away from heroism and descriptions of heroism. Like a pure spirit lying down, pulling its body over it. Like a bride her husband for a cover to keep her warm. Someone who goes with half a loaf of bread to a small place that fits like a nest around him. Someone who wants no more, who's not himself longed for by anyone else. He is a letter to everyone. You open it. It says, "Live."